This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. Every once in a while, a book in the religion aisle makes it to the top of the bestseller list, a book about Jesus, a book that challenges widely held beliefs and assumptions, a book that makes surprising claims. Those are the ingredients. An uber-controversial interview on Fox News doesn't hurt either. But Zealot, the new book by Reza Aslan, does more than get attention. It raises questions, uncomfortable questions for people of faith. How is the picture of Jesus in our heart, if you will, different from the one that historians can prove to our heads? And does it matter if there's a disparity between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith? Reza Aslan is joining us this morning from Los Angeles. Welcome to you, Reza.
Thank you so much for having me.
Glad you're here. At the risk of starting this interview the way another one began recently, I do want to ask, why did you write this book? And what I mean by that is you're a scholar and author who could probably get published on a lot of different topics these days. Why this one?
You know, I've been interested in Jesus both as a worshiper and as a scholar really since I was 15 years old. As I've said on numerous occasions, I became an evangelical Christian in high school. And then in college, when I decided to study the New Testament for a career, I noticed a great gap between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith. And to be perfectly frank, the Jesus of history became more interesting to me, became more real to me. And although I was no longer a Christian, I nevertheless continued my research in the historical Jesus and found in him a man who, as I say in the book, was every bit as compelling and charismatic and worthy of being followed, in fact, as the Christ of faith.
You acknowledge right up front in your book that you're not the first to ask these questions. Give us a little bit of a historical glimpse. How long have people been looking for the so-called historical Jesus?
Well, I suppose what's often referred to as the quest for the historical Jesus can be traced to Albert Schweitzer. So it's about a 200-year-old journey that scholars of the New Testament have been on. And you're right. I mean, as I quite obviously state in the book, I mean, what I am talking about in this book are things that biblical scholars have been talking about for centuries. What I've done is to bring that conversation to take it out of the ivory tower, if you will, and to make it appealing and accessible to a general audience. And so, in other words, if you are a Bible scholar, not much that I write in this book is going to come as a surprise to you, but the fact of the matter is that most people, whether they are people of faith or not, are unfamiliar with the discussions surrounding the historical Jesus, the discussions about how to read the Gospels, the historical examination of this man who lived 2,000 years ago in a land that was perhaps the most tumultuous era of the Holy Land, which obviously is saying a lot.
So to your way of thinking, to your historical understanding, who was Jesus?
Well, I think it's important to understand that the Jesus of history and the Jesus of faith may seem like two different people, but in reality, it's just a matter of perspective. In other words, if you look at Jesus as something or someone that was utterly unique, who had a completely different view about God and the nature of the relationship between creator and creation, who was unlike every other Jew in his time in the way that he understood the role of the law of Moses, who had a different perception of the Hebrew Scriptures than anyone else at his time, then you can have a perspective of him, an interpretation of him, as someone who was utterly unique and indeed perhaps even God incarnate. The historian's job, of course, is not to say, you know, what is possible when thinking about Jesus, but what is likely. And so what I do is I place Jesus firmly in the historical, social, political, and religious context of his time. And when you do that, a different kind of image arises out of from Jesus, an image of a man who, like 98% of his fellow Jews, was illiterate, uneducated. This was a poor, pious peasant from the backwoods of Galilee. If he was a woodworker, as he's referred to in the Gospels, he would have been on the second lowest rung of the social ladder, just above the slave, the indigent, and the beggar. He would have come from a city, Nazareth, that was so small, so inconsequential, so poor that its name does not appear on any map or document before the end of the first century. And yet, despite all that, through his charisma, through the power of his teachings, he was able to form a movement, the purpose of which was to create the kingdom of God on earth, to essentially reverse the social order of his time. You know, and his vision was one in which the rich would become poor and the poor would become rich, the first would be last, the last would be first. And in the name of the dispossessed, the marginalized, the poor, the weak, he challenged the religious and political authorities of his time and paid for it with his life.
I guess the criticism that many will have, and in fact have had, is that although you are placing Jesus in a historical context, you're saying what is likely, as you said. There isn't necessarily evidence to say that some of those elements of the more traditional Christian story are wrong. It's just that they're unlikely, which is different than proving that they're untrue. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And in fact, you know, one thing that is very important about this book is that it's received a very warm response from many, many Christians, in fact, devout Christians, who have said that while they disagree with my conclusion that Jesus was just a man, that they believe that Jesus was God incarnate, that they nevertheless found the book to be spiritually edifying in that the Jesus that they are often confronted with at church is of a celestial being. The idea of looking at Jesus as just a man in his place and time is one that I think few Christians have an opportunity to really delve into, which is why this book has been actually quite popular for a lot of Christian audiences. At the same time, and perhaps ironically so, the book has been popular with a bunch of atheist audiences who say, aha, see, this is the Jesus that I always knew existed, the Jesus who was just a poor, pious peasant and you know, not God incarnate. And you know, what's, I think, wonderful about those two different responses that I've had to this book is that it sums up essentially what Jesus is. I mean, Jesus has been many things to many people for many, many years. And it's all about how you approach this man and the sort of the presumptions that you bring to any kind of analysis of him. That's what defines who he is for you. And I think in many ways, you know, scholars can sort of say the same thing. I mean, we sift through thousands of years of historical documents, and we try to create the best image that we possibly can, based on the best, most educated guess that we have, which is why scholars, you know, have been debating this for so many years. We don't all agree with each other.
Sure. Now, there are a number of sort of specific events that Christians generally hold dear or list as important elements of Jesus' story as it's found in the Gospels and the New Testament. Many of those events you write about in the book as being, at the very best, unlikely. Indeed, you suggest that they probably didn't happen. Talk about a couple of those. You certainly raise some questions about the resurrection, for example.
Well, as a matter of fact, I don't raise questions about the resurrection because what I say is that it's the historian is incapable of commenting on the resurrection because the resurrection is, by definition, an ahistorical event. So I don't deal with the resurrection per se. What I do deal with, however, is with the resurrection claim. The fact of the matter is that it's you know, a matter of history that Jesus' followers claimed that he rose from the dead. And that's something that a historian can actually dig his teeth into. But you know, whether the resurrection happened or not is a question that a historian is not even allowed to ask, to be honest with you. But to your larger question, yes, there are a number of traditional stories about Jesus, his birth in Bethlehem, for instance, his trial before Pilate, that are, in your absolutely correct terms, historically unlikely. And there are a number of reasons that I talk about why that is. Here's the important thing that I want to emphasize. It's not about just simply saying this probably didn't happen and this probably did happen. It's understanding how to read the Gospels in the first place. You have to understand that our conception, what you and I mean when we say history, an accumulation of observable, verifiable facts and dates, would have been wholly a foreign concept to the ancient mind. That definition of history is barely 300 years old. For the ancient mind, and certainly for the gospel writers, history wasn't about revealing facts, it was about revealing truths. In other words, the gospel writers who wrote the gospels weren't writing down eyewitness accounts of observable and verifiable events. These were testimonies of faith written by communities of faith many years after the events that they described. To put it in this, in its simplest way, the gospel writers already believed something about Jesus, that he was the Messiah or God, and then they wrote the gospels to prove that belief. The gospels are not history, in other words, they are an argument. And so what we have to do as historians is take the claims of the gospels and place them alongside what we know of the history of that time, and if those claims do not fit the historical realities, then we say that they are unlikely.
One of the places you say that the claims don't seem to fit the historical realities surrounds the trial of Jesus. In fact, you write pretty flatly that there really wasn't a trial before Pilate, this sort of famous scene that is part of every passion story, every Holy Week in every Christian church. Why do you say that? How can you say it with such confidence?
Well, we know a lot about Pontius Pilate. He was the longest serving governor, or the second longest serving governor in Jerusalem. And what we know about him is that he was a hard, brutal, violent man who on a regular basis sent his troops onto the streets of Jerusalem to slaughter the Jews when they disagreed with even the slightest of his decisions. In fact, he sent so many people to the cross, he sent so many Jews to the cross without trial, that a formal complaint was lodged against him in Rome, and indeed Caesar Augustus eventually removed him from his post because of his brutality. The notion that this man would have spent even a second of his time pondering the fate of yet another Jewish rabble-rouser, one of probably thousands that he had sent to the cross, you know, that year alone, let alone that he would be so convinced of his innocence that he would beg the Jews to please let him release them, but then would ultimately be strong-armed by the Jews, be literally forced by the Jews to send this innocent man to the cross, is, as I've been saying, historically unlikely. And the reason I think that the story was created in the first place has to do with who the Gospels were intended for. We have to understand that these Gospels were intended primarily for a non-Jewish audience. It's why they were written in Greek. It's why they constantly have to explain Jewish terms and Jewish customs. And when you're writing for a non-Jewish audience, when you're trying to sort of convince a primarily Roman audience to convert to this new movement, you have to do three things to Jesus. Number one, you have to make him slightly less Jewish. In other words, you have to take the Jewish context out of his teachings, turn them into abstract universal principles that all people can abide by. Number two, you have to make sure that you temper some of Jesus's revolutionary sentiments. I mean, you can't convince Rome to follow a religion founded by a man whose principal goal was to remove the Roman occupation of Judea. And number three, you have to remove all blame from Rome for Jesus' death. It's hard to convince Romans to worship a figure that the Romans put to death as a criminal, as you know, for the crime of treason and sedition. And so what happens from the first gospel, Mark, to the fourth gospel, John, is this steady progression whereby slowly, responsibility for Jesus' death is removed from Rome and placed directly on the Jews. Indeed, in the Gospel of John, the Jews cry out as a single nation that may Jesus' blood be on our heads and on our children's heads and on our children's children's heads, thus launching some 2,000 years of Christian anti-Semitism.
Well, we need to take a break, but we do want to invite our listeners to be part of the conversation. What are your questions for Reza Aslan? If you're a person of faith, does it matter to you if there isn't an exact match between the Christ at the heart of your faith and the historical person of Jesus? What concerns do you have about the scholarship, especially if you've read the book that that you've heard from Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, written by our guest, Reza Aslan? We'll continue that conversation after our break. Our phone number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also post comments at our Facebook page, the KCUR Facebook page, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today with Reza Aslan, author of Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, having a conversation about the historical Jesus and the Christ of faith, a look at some of the claims and research that have emerged from his book about Jesus, what Jesus was like, who he was as a historical figure, as well as the controversy that has surrounded this book in some quarters. We hope you'll call us at 816-235-2888 to share your questions. You can also post your comments on KCUR's Facebook page or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Steve in Lawrence has called in. Steve, welcome to Central Standard.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I had two questions for Dr. Aslan. One was, as regards the historical mindset of the Gospels, I know that the Gospel of Luke, for example, begins with what we'd recognize as a modern historical consciousness. He said he had interviewed eyewitnesses and had set events down in order, and he was writing for evidently an educated Roman man. I would ask about that, and I would also ask, Dr. Aslan characterized Jesus as illiterate in the Gospel of Luke. Jesus' public ministry begins with him in the synagogue reading from the scroll of Isaiah, and another place reference is made to Jesus kneeling and writing on the ground. This is a society, too, where literacy is valued as a religious duty. So I would ask Dr. Aslan to respond to those two questions. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for calling in, Steve. Good questions. Reza Aslan, let's address the second one first. You do say that Jesus was an illiterate peasant, and yet the Gospels portray him as an articulate public speaker and actually portray him reading aloud from the Torah scroll in the synagogue. Where do you get that?
Well, first of all, again, I think it's important to understand that just because something is said in the Gospels doesn't mean that it's historically accurate. Remember that the Gospels are making an argument, not recording history.
Well, and
the
okay,
the
then
matter
maybe,
is that,
maybe we can add the other portion of Steve's question in then as well, because
right, exactly.
The Gospel of Luke does, in fact,
right.
articulate that it pretends, at least, it presents itself
right.
as a historical document.
Right, right. So just to finish up the first point very, very quickly. So again, is it possible that Jesus, unlike 98% of his fellow Jews, could read and write? Yes, it is possible. But I think that that's mostly a matter of a faith statement. Is it likely? No, it's not likely. The fact of the matter is that someone in Jesus' economic situation would have never spent a day in a school. The only kind of education that a tecton or a woodworker would have had is in his chosen trade. In fact, we know that in Nazareth there were no schools in Nazareth. There was no synagogue in Nazareth. There were no roads in Nazareth. So again, it's just a matter of placing him in his time and saying, is it more or less likely? And frankly, to the larger question about literacy being valued in Jesus's time, that's actually not the case. The only Jews in Jesus's time who could read and write were the priestly aristocracy, the priests, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes. whose job was to read and write. And if you weren't one of these people, it's very unlikely that you would be able to read or write, and Jesus was not one of these people. So those sections in the Gospels in which we do see Jesus reading and writing are historically unlikely and really just meant to make a larger point about Jesus. Luke, I think, is a perfect example of this. Luke, of course, is writing his Gospel sometime between the years 90 and 100 A.D., so between 60 and 70 years after Jesus is dead. And again, what Luke refers to as eyewitnesses are, there's no such thing as, I mean, there's nobody who is alive in 90 who hung out with Jesus in the 20s and the 30s. But what he's referring to is talking to people about the traditions that have been passed along. And those traditions are Christological traditions. They are traditions about Jesus as God. They are faith statements, not eyewitness accounts, unfortunately. I'll give you just one very, very quick example of what I mean by this. Luke says that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. He has to be born in Bethlehem because some of the prophecies about the Messiah say that he has to be born in Bethlehem. The problem is that Luke knows that Jesus is a Nazarene. That's how he is known. So he has to get Jesus from Nazareth to Bethlehem. So he says that in the year 6 CE, there's this census of the entire Roman world that forces everyone to get up and travel great distances to the land of their father's birth and wait there to be counted. And so Jesus and his family get up and move from Nazareth to Bethlehem, where his father is from, and in Bethlehem he is born. Now, we know a lot about Roman taxation law. The Romans were very, very good at documentation, particularly when it came to taxes. And this law just simply never existed. And in fact, it's kind of ridiculous to think that every once in a while, every subject person of the largest empire the world had ever known at the time would have to uproot themselves and their family, travel great distances to the land of their father's birth, and then wait there for a Roman official to come and count them. And their property, which, by the way, they would have left back in their place of residence in the first place, this never happened. This story is simply unhistorical. But here's the important thing that I want to emphasize for Steve. Luke knew that this story was unhistorical. He was living under Roman domination. I mean, everybody who read Luke's gospel knew that this story was not factually correct. They were living under Roman dominion. They understood how Roman taxation law went, but nobody cared because the facts of that story were irrelevant to the ancient mind. It's the truth of the story that matters, which is that Jesus is the descendant of King David, born in the city of David. And I know that this is an incredibly difficult thing for the modern mind to understand, but in the ancient world, fact and truth meant two different things. For us, fact by definition means truth. They are one and the same.
Right.
But in the ancient world, those were two separate things. The truth that was revealed in a story was more important than the facts of the story.
But Reza, I mean, even some historians who accept that there's a distinction between fact and truth in the ancient world's understanding are questioning your presentation of the facts. And now, for example, Stephen Prothero in the Washington Post, who is certainly not representing a conservative Christian viewpoint, his review of your book includes this few sentences. Aslan is more a storyteller here than a historian. Throughout Zealot, he refers to selected New Testament passages as preposterous, fanciful, patently fictitious. But Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are not the only ones spinning Jesus's out of fertile imaginations. The real problem is that Aslan, like thousands of historical Jesus experts before him, refuses to say, "I don't know," with anything near the frequency required for the task. He, too, purports to be an intrepid archaeologist for historical truth, excavating the real Jesus out of propagandistic legend that has grown up around him. But he, too, remakes Jesus in his own image. Is that a fair critique?
Well, unfortunately, Professor Protheros should have actually read my notes. I mean, I have 100 pages of notes, and I don't do anything methodologically speaking than every single Bible scholar, as he himself says, has done. So it's not this idea that I think a lot of non-experts of the Bible say that, oh, you're just picking and choosing the verses that you like. The fact of the matter is that the methodology for deciding what is more likely historical and what is less likely historical is 200 years old. Every Bible scholar uses the exact same methodology. Now, there may be disagreements about which verses are historical and which are not. There may be arguments that say, well, no, we disagree with, you know, the historicity of this statement that, instead of that one. And what I do in my book, in the 100 pages of notes, is lay out that debate. I reference every scholar who disagrees with me and every scholar who agrees with me. Unfortunately, that review comes from a place of faith. In fact, the reviewer says, you know, that he refuses to believe in the Jesus that I you know, write about. Well, I'm not asking anyone to believe in this Jesus because I'm not making a faith statement. I'm making a scholarly statement, one that, again, you know, thousands of scholars before me have made.
Sure. One of the obvious, most famous now critiques of your work came in an interview that you had on Fox News with Lauren Green. Obviously, this, to many, is what made your book so popular. Many have seen that that interview. It runs about 10 minutes. We're going to actually just play a little bit of the beginning of the interview for those who might not have heard it. This is Lauren Green on Fox News interviewing Reza Aslan.
Reza Aslan was a Christian but converted back to the faith of his forefathers. It's Islam. He has now written a book about Jesus. The book has become controversial as it calls into question some of the core tenets of Christianity. The book is called Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. And Reza joins me now from Los Angeles. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is an interesting book. Now, I want to clarify, you're a Muslim, so why did you write a book about the founder of Christianity?
Well, to be clear, I am a scholar of religions with 4 degrees, including one in the New Testament and fluency in Biblical Greek, who has been studying the origins of Christianity for 2 decades, who also just happens to be a Muslim. So it's not that I'm just some Muslim writing about Jesus. I am an expert with a PhD in the history of religions. But I have been obsessed
with
Jesus.
Though, it still begs the question, why would you be interested in the founder of Christianity?
Because it's my job as an academic. I am a professor of religion, including the New Testament. That's what I do for a living, actually. So, I mean, it would be like asking a Christian why they would write a book about, you know, Islam. I'm not sure about that.
That was Reza Aslan speaking on Fox News on July 26th with reporter Lauren Green. Reza, I know you've probably watched or heard that interview now many times.
Too many times, actually.
I'm sure. What is your reaction to it in retrospect?
Well, look, I mean, as I've said repeatedly, I completely understand where Lauren is coming from. I mean, I used to be an evangelical Christian, that's as she is. And I remember feeling, you know, under attack and threatened when anyone questioned sort of the fundamental beliefs that I held. So I have nothing but compassion and understanding for Lauren. To the larger point that this book is some sort of, you know, Muslim attack on Jesus, which, by the way, the Washington Post reviewer that you just mentioned said the exact same thing, said that my Jesus is just a failed Muhammad, which is just as a bigoted statement as, you know, just the fact that I happen to be Muslim means that I'm attacking Jesus. As I mentioned to Lauren Green, I overturn almost everything that Islam says about Jesus, and in fact, I've had just as many disgruntled Muslims writing to me and emailing as I've had Christians. My faith background is irrelevant to my scholarly pursuits. In fact, I wrote a book about the historical Muhammad called No God But God, which also overturned almost everything that we know about the prophet Muhammad. So I think that ultimately this is a larger question about the role of scholarship and faith, religion and society, and anti-intellectualism in the media. And I get it. I mean, when you write about religion for a living, you're writing about something that people take very, very seriously. So I have no, you know, bad feelings at all towards Fox or towards Lauren Green or towards anyone else for that matter. I get why people are so passionate about these topics.
You know, it's interesting to hear you say that you think it is completely irrelevant. If we were to unearth a nugget of merit to the questions that Lauren Green was asking, you know, I'm a Presbyterian minister, as some listeners mm-hmm. know. I interview people all the time, though, about matters of religion, including religions other than my own. I'm not sure I would agree that the perspective of the interviewer or the scholar or the author is of no relevance when covering issues of faith.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right insofar as there's no such thing as objective history, that, you know, history is as much about the person doing the analysis as it is about the events being analyzed. You're absolutely right. In fact, I make that claim in the opening pages of my book that, you know, the great Christian theologian Rudolf Bultmann once said that, you know, we often see the Jesus that we want to see. And I completely acknowledge that. But I think that the Jesus, if that's true in my regard, that any kind of, bias that I bring to my historical search has little to do with my religion, which, as I say, I mean, I overturn what my religion has to say about Jesus. I overturn what the Quran actually says about Jesus, and perhaps has more to do with my worldview, the way that I think about these larger issues about, you know, prophecy and the role of God and humanity and social good and social justice. I mean, a number of commentators have actually mentioned that I was trained by Jesuit priests. My academic work in the New Testament was done under the supervision of Jesuit priests. And if you know anything about the Jesuits, they are obsessed with social justice and the preferential option for the poor. And so I readily admit that that probably influenced the way that I analyze the history, the way that I think about Jesus as someone whose entire ministry was founded upon social justice and care for the poor. That is something that you can certainly charge me with having a preconceived bias of. But you can't really charge me with having a religious bias when, again, as I've mentioned, I actually challenge and overturn most of what my own religion has to say about Jesus.
Before we go, just maybe 30 seconds left here, you did write this book for a popular audience. I guess I'm wondering what you hope a devout or pious Christian or for that matter, a Muslim who reveres Jesus as a prophet would take from it. Or to put it another way, I like my Christ of faith better than I like your Jesus of history, someone might say. What do you say to that person?
Well, first of all, I say that's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that, and you should continue liking your Christ of faith. But the foundation of Orthodox Christianity is that Jesus was fully God and fully man. If you believe that, then you need to understand the fully man part. That man lived in a specific time and place, and that time and place influenced who he was. It shaped his teachings. His message was directed against the social ills of his time. His actions were against the powers of his time. So if you really want to know who this man was, you need to know the world in which he lived, because that world matters.
That's Reza Aslan. He's Associate Professor of Creative Writing at the University of California, Riverside. His book is Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, on sale everywhere now. Reza Aslan, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
My apologies to Theo and Matt and Dale, whose calls we didn't get to, but the conversation will certainly continue on Twitter and on Facebook, where the conversation is already well underway. You can subscribe to our podcast. You can find any of our previous shows on the Central Standard page at kcur.org. Join us tomorrow as we explore the financial ins and outs of opening up a small business. Stay tuned now for Up to Date with a preview of some of tonight's TEDxKC speakers. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Susanna Hogan with Ross Steinmetz. I'm Brian Ellison. This is KCUR.